I'm Miles George, the Managing Director of Infogen, and joining me today to present this result is Chris Vavistock, our Chief Financial Officer. The agenda for this presentation is set out on slide 2 of the pack that was released with our result this morning. I'll briefly address the key outcomes outlined in the early slides, followed by Chris, who will present the group's financial performance, and then I'll address the operational performance in the US and Australia. I'll also provide a brief update on the regulatory and market environment and the outlook for the business. Following the presentations, I'll then open the line for questions. So turning on to slide 3, I'm pleased to report our safety performance on a rolling 12-month basis was steady at 1.2, but we continue to strive to have zero safety incidents in our business. Production was up 1% to 4,670 gigawatt hours. Revenue was up 6% to $303.2 million as a result of higher production and favourable foreign exchange movements. Group operating costs were $118 million and were steady in both the US and Australia, with translation into Australian dollars attributable to the annual increase. We reported a net gain on sale of $4.4 million from the sale of US development projects that we announced earlier in the year. Chris will cover off the financing line items and institutional equity partnerships in more detail, but I'll just mention that we recorded a significant item expense of $16.8 million in relation to two interest rate swap terminations due to counterparties exercising their early termination rights. We reported this expense at our interim results and had previously foreshadowed the likelihood of this outcome. The reported net loss of $8.9 million was an improvement of $71.1 million after payment of the $16.8 million swap termination costs, the value of which were previously recognised through equity. Before significant items, our net profit after tax was $8.9 million. Net operating cash flow was up 14% to $96.2 million and would have increased 34% to $113 million had it not been for the interest rate swap termination costs. We outperformed guidance of $80 million in cash flow available for reduction of liabilities by $13.5 million. Turning to slide 4, the 1% production improvement reflected better wind conditions in Australia and the US. Revenue of $303.2 million was up 6% or $17.1 million. Higher production and higher REC prices in the US were partially offset by lower Australian LGC prices and lower compensated revenue in Australia. Full-year operating costs were within the guidance ranges of $73 to $76 million in the US and $35 to $37 million in Australia. A summary of the main increases and decreases in operating costs is provided on this slide, which I'll discuss in more detail when discussing performance at a regional level. I'm pleased to report that we benefited from the cost-saving initiatives and organisation restructure previously announced. Expensed development costs were up $3 million, primarily reflecting costs of further progressing attractive development opportunities in the US. Corporate costs were down $0.5 million. This was primarily due to the organisation restructure and cost-saving initiatives announced in 2013, partially offset by costs associated with undertaking market testing for the potential sale of Capital Wind Farm. The gain on sale of US solar development projects added $4.4 million to EBITDA, which was 7% higher at $170 million. A $19.1 million increase in US IEP income was largely offset by the interest rate swap termination costs. The underlying borrowing costs were relatively steady. All of these factors contributed to a net loss of $8.9 million, which was an improvement of $71.1 million. The prior year included a $58.4 million impairment charge related to the US cash-generating unit. I'll now hand over to Chris Vavistock to discuss the group's financial performance.
Thanks, Miles. Slide 6 sets out the summary statutory P&L and associated metrics. Following the change in accounting standards, which precludes the use of the proportional consolidation method previously employed, we've restated, as required, the prior corresponding period. A detailed reconciliation, including the previously stated figures, is included within the financial statements. On to slide 7. This bridges the statutory view to the economic interest. As a result of the accounting standards change just mentioned, this is slightly different to prior year full presentations. The reconciliation first involves eliminating the non-controlling interests in two USA wind farms, where our B-class controlling interest exceeds 50% and is less than 100%, and then grossing up each P&L line item for the 7 joint ventures that were accounted for using the equity method. While Infogen naturally continues to prepare the group's financial statements on a fully IFRS-compliant basis, we remain of the view that an economic interest or proportionally consolidated perspective is the most meaningful one. This reflects the way the group internally manages its financials, as is apparent from our segment information disclosure in our consolidated financial statements, by the way of Note 2. From here on, the presentation for all financials will be on an economic interest basis. As for other briefings, I would also draw your attention to our Management Discussion and Analysis, MD&A, which supplements this presentation. Slide 8 sets out the summary economic P&L and associated metrics for FY14 and the prior corresponding period, or PCP. The main period-on-period drivers will be examined in subsequent slides. Below the EBITDA level, the principal observations are net borrowing costs, revaluation of financial instruments, and allocation of return together were $71.4 million, down 14% or $11.9 million. This primarily reflected the appreciation of the AUD and the revaluation of the USD and Euro debt held by an Australian company within the group at 30 June 2014 and the return on the US Class A interests acquired earlier in the year. Termination of interest rate swaps resulted in an expense of $16.8 million. As a result of hedge accounting, this item had already been reflected in security holders' equity in prior periods. Net income from US institutional equity partnerships was $48.4 million, up 65% or $19.1 million compared with $29.3 million in the PCP. As the deferred revenue brought to account in the prior periods now unwinds more fully and is offset as more LLCs become taxable. All of the benefits of accelerated tax depreciation have now largely been realised. Further details, including explanation of the structure of IEPs, including accounting treatment, are available in Appendix B of the full year FY14 MD&A. Income tax benefit was $2.6 million compared with $4.5 million in the PCP and is broadly consistent with the loss before tax for the period. Turning to slide 9, this sets out the revenue bridge from FY13 to FY14. The principal features were higher production in Australia and the US. Electricity prices were lower in both regions. US benefited from higher REC prices while Australia endured lower LGC prices. Compensated revenue was lower, predominantly due the prior year including a receipt following the resolution of an AEMO scheduling error. Finally, the lower average AUD against the USD during the year contributed $16 million in AUD terms to revenue. Slide 10 sets out the operating EBITDA bridge for FY13 to FY14. The first item, revenue, was addressed on the previous slide. Underlying operating costs decreased $2.1 million as a result of the cost savings initiatives announced in February 2013 and savings in professional fees due to one-off legal costs in relation to the AEMO dispute in Australia and the Gamesa dispute in the US that recurred in the PCP. These savings were offset by incentive payments to service and maintenance providers for increased availability and production, for which we received more revenue, and transaction costs related to the acquisition of the US Class A interests. The favourable FX movement that benefited revenue in AUD terms had the reverse effect on costs of $8.4 million. Turning to slide 11, the items set out in the waterfall are for the most part self-explanatory. Corporate development and other non-operating costs and income below the operating EBITDA line were $15.5 million for the period, compared to $18.6 million in the PCP, and the variances have been addressed by Miles. The working capital outflow of $4.2 million is largely a timing difference attributable to the increased number of LGCs at balance date, as much of this increase was sold in the last week of June and early July and was cash settled therefore in July. We received distributions of $16.8 million from our newly acquired Class A interests. Once again, you see on the table in the graph the effect of the swap termination cost of net operating cash flow. The net effect was net operating cash flow of 96 6.6 million, up 12.4 million or 14%. Slide 12 summarises the movement in cash over the year to the end of FY14, as well as identifying the cash balance held outside the bank group, excluded company cash. Most elements, again, are self-explanatory. In terms of cash inflows, we just discussed the operating cash flow, which is the first item. We drew down a debt facility that we sourced to fund the acquisition of certain US Class A interests. The sale of US development projects contributed $8.3 million on a gross basis. We refinanced the Woodlawn project finance facility and drew down the balance. In terms of cash outflows, we used cash to repay Global Facility, Woodlawn and Union Bank debt and repay the old Woodlawn facility on refinancing. We used cash to reduce Class A liabilities. The Union Bank facility and existing cash were used to fund the acquisition of the Class A interests, and capital expenditure was primarily related to capacitor bank installations at Sweetwater, expenditure related to post-warranty agreements at sites with Gamesa turbines and development activities, and residual outflows related to FX financing and other costs. Slide 13 sets out the impact of FX on the P&L and on the principal balance sheet items. The P&L impact can be seen to move from a positive at the EBITDA level to a slight negative at the before tax level. The balance sheet calculations highlight the non-cash benefit of FX translation of our borrowings and Class A IEP balances at balance date. There was also significant unrealised FX movements across other categories of the balance sheet, particularly PP&E and intangibles. Slide 14 gives the balance sheet at 30th June and 30 June 2014 and 30 June 2013. The principal features are an increase in borrowings due to the Union Bank facility drawdown, offset by repayment of Global Facility borrowing, scheduled repayments of the Woodlawn and Union Bank facilities and FX. Interest rate swap termination costs, as previously outlined, and the movement in forward interest rates resulted in a $22.4 million reduction to the interest rate derivative liability. The Global Facility Leverage Ratio Covenant was satisfied for the period ended 30 June 2014. Slide 15 simply summarises the movement in borrowings and Class A capital balances. The Woodlawn facility was refinanced during the year with 5-year and 10-year term loans in two equal tranches. This concludes the financial results part of the presentation, and I'll hand back to Miles for the operational review.
Thanks, Chris. Now, if we turn to slide 17, the small production increase reflected better wind conditions and steady site availability, partially offset by lower turbine availability at GSG and Mendota in the US, where the maintenance has transitioned to Gamesa and work was being undertaken to achieve higher long-term availability. The 1% revenue increase reflects higher production, higher REC revenue and higher merchant electricity prices, offset by lower electricity prices at Crescent Ridge and lower compensated revenue. The 3% operating EBITDA increase reflects higher revenue and stable costs. US development activity has increased with attractive opportunities identified and progressed. Our investment in certain US Class A interests has improved the cash flow profile of the US business and of the group. As mentioned before, we achieved a profitable sale of Wildwood and Pumpjack solar development assets. On to slide 18, the decreased asset management costs reflected lower legal costs following the resolution of the Gamesa dispute and restructure cost savings. These were partly offset by transaction costs for acquisition of Class A interests. We incurred higher turbine O&M costs related to the Gamesa warranty and maintenance agreements and for Mitsubishi or MHI availability incentive payments. The increase in balance of plant costs was due to higher maintenance costs and equipment upgrades, while other direct costs decrease reflected lower transmission and connection fees and lower insurance and tax expenses. As I mentioned earlier, we were within our full-year operating cost guidance of between $73 and $76 million. During the year, we executed a 5-year extended warranty service and maintenance agreement with MHI for the Combine Hills wind farm, and these types of post-warranty service and maintenance agreements continue to support cost containment. Moving now to the Australian business on slide 19. Excuse me. The 4% production increase reflected better wind conditions at all wind farms except Alinta and higher turbine availability. Regrettably, not all of the production increase translated into higher revenue. The 1% revenue decrease reflected lower LGC prices, lower electricity prices, and higher compensated revenue in the prior year, which was mostly offset by higher production. Australia's operating costs decreased due to the organisation restructure and cost-saving initiative undertaken in 2013, offset by incentive payments to O&M service providers for exceeding availability and production targets. Marginally lower operating EBITDA was due to lower revenue and mostly attributable to a subdued LGC market. Over to slide 20. Lower asset management costs were a result of cost savings initiatives implemented in early 2013. Higher turbine O&M costs were primarily due to higher unscheduled turbine maintenance at Alinta and higher variable incentive payments at wind farms with Vestas turbines. This year, higher scheduled and unscheduled balance of plant works increased costs offset by lower insurance costs and lower professional fees for energy markets activities. Operating costs this year reflect a fully contracted turbine warranty and maintenance profile. We are in discussions with service providers to provide post-warranty services at Capital, which will transition off warranty later in FY15, with Woodlawn to follow in FY17. As with the US, the Australian business was again within the full year guidance range for operating costs of between 35 to 37 million. Moving now to the market and regulatory update and outlook, starting on slide 22. While US regulation and market prices have some effect on our business, it is important to note that our US asset portfolio has 80% of its output contracted, with a remaining weighted average contract duration of 10.5 years. There's been little change to modelled forecast long-term electricity and REC prices since we last reported. Slide 23 illustrates the continuing strong state-level support for renewables in the US. The state renewable portfolio standards will provide build signals for renewables through to the end of the decade and beyond. The federal investment tax credit for solar development is also in place until December 2016. Tackling climate change has become a prominent issue in the US recently, with the EPA releasing a rule proposal in February this year that seeks to reduce US carbon emissions by 30% of 2005 levels by 2030. Secretary of State John Kerry is also pursuing a campaign for global action on emissions reductions. Recently, the US and China committed to collaborate through enhanced policy dialogue, including the sharing of information regarding their respective plans to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Moving to slide 24, the Australian regulatory outlook. This contrasts dramatically with the US. A review of the renewable energy target was undertaken in the second half of FY14 through to early FY15, and based on some recent commentary, security holders' investments and lenders' capital may be at significant risk. Any adverse change to the RET without adequate grandfathering or compensation of existing investments will destroy substantial shareholder value and threaten our ability to meet debt obligations. Furthermore, changes to the legislated LRET trajectory, that's the large-scale scheme trajectory, would likely affect the carrying value of our assets. We have advised government ministers that Infogen's many international infrastructure investors and lenders would regard an adverse change to the RET legislation as a realisation of sovereign risk. Slide 25 highlights the adverse revenue implications to Infogen should the government seek to legislate any of the changed RET scenarios considered by the RET review panel. Our estimates are based on the outputs of the modelling undertaken by ASIL Allen for the government's panel, which assumes no grandfathering of existing investments. In all scenarios, Infogen would suffer significant loss of revenue relative to the legislated target. Slide 26 demonstrates the effect of the current regulatory uncertainty is having on the market, with bundled wholesale electricity and LGC prices significantly below the $90 to $100 per megawatt hour new build price requirement. Not only does this fail to stimulate new build, but it is insufficient to preserve the value of existing investments. In SA, where Infigen has most of its merchant exposure, there are minor improvements in forward electricity prices, reflecting the anticipated ramp-up of East Coast gas LNG exports. The national electricity market has an oversupply of old coal-fired generation, and electricity demand forecasts remain highly uncertain, leading to an unpredictable wholesale electricity price outlook. LGC forward prices remain at depressed levels as a result of acute regulatory uncertainty and well below the previous trading levels when there was confidence in the legislated targets. Slide 27 shows that wind is currently competitive with traditional fossil fuel technologies when comparing like with like new build costs. Regrettably, old inefficient plant is being allowed to run to failure to delay remediation and closure costs. As a result, the long-run cost of wind often unrealistically gets compared to the short-run cost of fully depreciated thermal plant, particularly by the owners of thermal plant, who also dominate electricity retailing. On slide 28, we've highlighted again the growing opportunity for renewable energy in Australia, driven by the large-scale renewable energy target legislation, once regulatory predictability returns. While the graph demonstrates that there are sufficient LGCs to meet demand until 2017, without any new build, the LGC market would be short by 2018. Excuse me. Under a reduced target, the LGC surplus would extend to 2019, threatening the viability of existing renewable investments by changing the LGC supply-demand equilibrium. Furthermore, a reduced RET would freeze investment, increase electricity prices, increase Australian taxpayer-funded costs of emissions reductions under direct action, and boost existing coal-fired generation profits. Experts agree that the real drivers of electricity price rises are increasing network costs now and rapidly rising gas prices over the next few years, not the RET. Moving now to our guidance for FY15, the outlook on slide 30. We'll continue to provide unaudited quarterly production and revenue outcomes with prior corresponding period comparatives, but expect some production improvement in the US and a similar outcome to FY14 in Australia. We expect some slight price improvements in the US, but have a much weaker expectation of prices in Australia following the removal of the carbon price and the ongoing weak LGC prices, which remain highly uncertain. We have set out our wind farm cost guidance ranges for the US and Australia, with the caveat that favourable production and availability performances may lead to incentive payments to service and maintenance providers, and above-average lightning strike insurance excess costs are not provided for in the guidance. The incentive payments would be more than offset by associated revenue. In FY15, US operating costs are forecast to be between $76 and $78 million, and Australian operating costs between $36.5 and $38 million. Cash generated to repay global facility borrowings and reduce Class A liabilities is expected to be approximately $90 million, subject to currently forecast merchant electricity and LGC prices being achieved. More generally, the outlook for Infigen's Australian business is currently highly uncertain. This is primarily attributable to regulatory instability caused by the latest RET review and associated industry and political positioning and commentary. LGC prices are currently significantly below those required to sustain existing investment or encourage new investment. If this situation were to continue, it would likely lead to significant asset impairments across the industry, including for Infigen. Continuing depressed prices would also create significant pressure on Infigen's capacity to meet financial covenants in our borrowing facilities. Thank you. That concludes our results presentation, and I'd now like to open the lines for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. We will just pause for a moment to allow questioners to enter the queue. Your first question comes from David Leach with UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just wondered, Miles, you talk about, well, two questions. One, I guess, is about the ending of the PTC benefits. Firstly, I wondered what impact will that have on the cash flows and financial statements over the next couple of years?
Okay. Well, I'll have a crack at it first, and I might ask Chris to have a think about perhaps providing a better answer, but... So the PTC benefits, the tax benefits go to the Class A investors. We have a small Class A holding, but in general, the PTC benefits are very rapidly running out. In terms of the cash effect on us, I don't believe there is any, but Chris, opine on the accounting.
PTCs effect. Go to retire the Class A liability.
I figured that. So I was thinking if they run out, that that liability will actually go on for longer. That's all I was, and it will take that much, you know, to the extent you're not getting PTCs, you have to get your return on the Class A out of the cash, and therefore, you know, less of the cash actually ends up retiring, and more of it goes into the just providing the annual return to the Class A, or am I not thinking about that the right way?
Well, I think that, yeah, that's true. As they obviously they flip over, you get decreasing Class B and increasing Class A outflows funding it. And obviously, without the PTCs, yes, you're funding the return through cash.
That's right. So when you have the slide that says that there's I forget how many million dollars. A good number, $90 million, to reduce Class A liabilities. But I guess my point is, some of that $90 million will end up being used for return rather than actual repayment of the liability. Or is, again, am I asking the question the wrong way?
Yeah, but that's certainly part of the equation. So, but the $90 million is split between obviously global facility and Class A.
Yeah, I think David's question, is right. That if you point, David, is that the the period has been extended a bit, and therefore some of that return has to be provided by cash that would have otherwise been provided by tax benefits. The answer is yes.
Yeah, so I was just trying to see whether it was an unpredicted change or it was all just pretty much in line with what you're expecting. But anyway, not to worry about it. And then my second question broadly was about asset write-downs. I just from my memory, and I apologise, they don't actually asset write. Does the asset value affect the global covenant directly, or is it the underlying cash flows changing that would affect the covenants?
Cash flows. So the asset write down is below the EBITDA level, so that, and there would be a significant item, you would imagine.
Yes. So, but there's no asset level coverage required. It's a cash flow coverage. Okay. Thank you. That's all I really want. When, I guess, would you have to think about those write-downs if required? Would that be like after something went through the Senate or something like that?
Yeah, David, we've taken the view that in this reporting to point out that there is significant uncertainty before that event. And you're right, once that event happens, whatever the government response is, we'll have to consider whether that event... constitutes a reason to make, you know, to take an impairment, for example. We'd have to consider that in the context of the fact that a government announcement these days doesn't necessarily mean legislation will pass. But we will have to consider that, of course, when the government makes an announcement.
Yes. All right. Well, good luck with the renewable target anyway. I think it's getting pretty rough treatment at the moment, but not much can be done. Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, David.
Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Steve Johnson with Forager Funds Management. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Just a really quick one on the global facility. Now that you've repaid some of those swaps, what do you expect the interest cost to be this year?
broadly in line with what you can see if you go to the actual financial statements, you'll see the actual interest expense in there, and broadly in line with that, less obviously the debt amortization for the period, or the interest component of that. So around the 70 mark.
Thanks.
As there are no further questions at this time, I'll now hand back to Mr. George for closing remarks.
Okay, well, look, thanks for participating in this call this afternoon. If anybody does have any last questions, we're happy to take one more, but otherwise we'll wind it up. So I'll just see if there's any last questions.
No questions from the phone.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for participating this afternoon.